Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Here's some interesting news just crossing the wire. A Boston appeals court has found that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. This would be a federal court ruling that says Congress cannot tell some states that they don't have to recognize marriages legally performed in other states. That's the Defense of Marriage Act, to let states that don't endorse gay marriage not to recognize marriages that are proposed in other states, among other provisions. So this may be headed for the Supreme Court now. A Boston appeals court has found that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. That just in. But let's turn our attention overseas. A shooting war, a virtual war, and a watershed moment for human rights all coming together today. Mark the date, May 30th, 2012, yesterday, when a former president was sentenced to 50 years behind bars for war crimes by an international court. Could the same thing happen to Bashar al-Assad for the Hula massacre in Syria last week? We'll talk about both these developments now and touch on the computer virus known as Flame that reportedly has transmitted many Iranian government emails to outside spies over the last 2 years. Afshin Mallavi is here, senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and former Tehran-based correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks for coming on, Afshin. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Syria first. Can the Hula massacre, 108 people reported killed last week in Hula, Syria, including many women and children in their homes, killed apparently by pro-government forces, can this be the turning point that winds up stopping Assad? You know, it's getting that last straw kind of press, and the West is reacting by expelling Syrian ambassadors. But do the media coverage and diplomatic punishment amount to anything?
You know, I think it's a good question you raise, because it does feel like we're on the verge of a tipping point. Having said that, however, when you look at the trajectory of these Arab uprisings, two things usually happen for the people or for the uprising to be victorious. One is that the leader loses his will to kill, and the other is that the army tells the leader it's time to go. Neither of those obtain right now in Syria. Now, whether or not that will change remains to be seen. But the army has, and the high-ranking members of the army have remained pretty resolute in their support of Assad. Assad has shown very little in the way of an unwillingness to kill his own people, and those two elements are not there right now. So, in the last piece of it is we're still waiting to see where Russia goes with this. Russia, to a lesser extent China, have been holding the United Nations Security Council tied back for a more forceful Security Council action on Syria. And as you know, there's very little in the way of appetite here in Washington for another military engagement in the Middle East. And so as a result of all those factors, it seems to me that Assad could survive certainly in the short term, but possibly into the medium term as well.
I want to ask you to explain Russia further and where they come in as a key Syrian big power ally. Here is a clip of Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations yesterday, trying to equate the Syrian rebels with the government forces. Listen.
Armed fighters are mingling with civilians. To us, this is not a new phenomenon. We have seen it from the outset of the crisis in Syria, when armed groups were taking, or armed people were trying to take advantage of peaceful demonstrators.
A false equivalency by almost anybody's standards, equating the rebels who are armed with the government troops with all the force that they have in committing these massacres. What do you make of it? Why does Russia do this?
Yeah, no, you know, I think, you know, what Russia is trying to do is they're trying to protect one of their most important allies in the region, Syria, a significant purchaser of Russian military equipment. And they're also, in one sense, Russia has something of a frustration about how things went down in Libya. They feel that some of the votes that they gave at the Security Council were translated too quickly into military action in Libya. But I agree with you. I mean, it's a false equivalency. Now, the Syrian rebels have taken up arms. They have not chosen the path of nonviolent civil resistance. And the reality is that a nonviolent civil resistance path works when the government cares about what the international community thinks of them. But in the case of Syria, the government doesn't really care what the international community thinks of them. And so in many ways, the rebels were forced into this position of taking up arms. And what we are on the verge of is potentially a civil war. There's a sectarian element here involved. The Syrian government is ruled by an Alawite minority. It's an offshoot of Shiism. But the vast majority of the country is a Sunni population. And what we're seeing right now is very much a sectarian element in which Alawites affiliated to the military, militias are going around Sunni villages and Sunni-controlled areas and going around and just killing people. And it's taking on a very sectarian tone a la Iraq. And it's getting very, very dangerous.
And I think those complexities are among the reasons that the Obama administration and some of the other Western allies feel paralyzed or at least torn about whether to arm the rebels or go in militarily in any other way. Here, for example, is U.S. UN Ambassador Susan Rice yesterday. If this is the strongest language that the U.S. can muster, then we have more conversations to have. Listen.
The Syrian government has made commitments. It's blatantly violated those commitments. I think it's quite clear, as we've said for many weeks, if they continue to do so, there should be consequences.
That vague word, consequences, it's got to be more than expelling the Syrian ambassador.
No, that's right. That's right. And you know, what has been striking is that, you know, from very early on in the uprising in Egypt, the Obama administration was very quick to say that, you know, Mubarak must step down. The Obama administration was slower on calling for Assad to step down. They have since said that. They have since said he's lost his legitimacy. But you're right in the sense that they do fear the hornet's nest. They don't want to be seen as going forward alone. But what Susan Rice also said was that we may be forced to go outside the Security Council. And what she's arguing is for a Libya-type discussion. Now, I don't think there's not many people in Washington where I sit right now talking about an air campaign in Syria. But Susan Rice was talking explicitly about efforts to support arming the rebels. Now, you know, again, that gets very complicated. It gets very difficult. But what she does have on her side is some very powerful Arab states who are actually already doing that, who are already providing money to the rebels. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, for one, the United Arab Emirates, the Gulf Cooperation Council states have already called for arming the rebels and are doing so to some extent. So, you know, the danger that we'll face is, you know, Syria becomes a Lebanon-type proxy battlefield where Iran comes in on one side in support of the Syrian government. Saudi Arabia and Qatar come in on another side in support of the rebels, and the Syrian people continue to suffer, caught in this geopolitical crossfire.
Right. And maybe a little correction is in order. If Susan Rice was speaking more strongly than she did in that clip, and if I portrayed that as cautious language by the United States, if she's really bringing up this question of arming the Syrian rebels. But she, of course, as UN ambassador, represents President Obama. And I thought the Obama position is that arming the Syrian rebels is something that he opposes because it just might make the situation worse with more civil war and therefore more innocent victims and more arms floating around to wind up in who knows whose hands eventually. And also that President Obama is not sure who the Syrian rebels are. including reports that some factions are quite hostile to the U.S., so why give them weapons?
Yeah, no, I think you're right in that characterization. What Susan Rice spelled out yesterday was kind of a three-part scenario whereby she said there's three options, you know, one of which is heavier diplomatic and economic sanctions on Syria. The other option is arming the rebels. And the third option is doing nothing and facing a catastrophe. And it was clear that she favored the diplomatic and more economic sanctions offer. So you're right in that characterization. But I thought it was interesting that she did bring up explicitly this idea of arming the rebels, which is something that, as you know, Senators McCain and Lieberman and Graham have argued for over the past few months. But no, there is clearly an effort by Susan Rice and the Obama administration to marshal far more robust diplomatic and economic sanctions on Syria than what we have right now.
Do you know if Romney has taken a position?
Romney has generally said that has been relatively vague. He has not. He has said President Obama needs to show more leadership on Syria. He has not explicitly endorsed the McCain-Lieberman-Graham position of calling for arming the rebels.
Unfortunately, we're not going to have time to get into the flame computer virus spying on Iran. We'll have to save that for a separate segment probably tomorrow. But before you go, Afshin, what do you think of the Charles Taylor sentencing yesterday in relation to this? It's Liberia, it's an unrelated country, but can that kind of international act of justice against a murderous head of state, something we've rarely, if ever, seen since Nuremberg, serve as a deterrent to people like Assad?
The answer is yes, it can. Now, legally, it's actually more difficult to prosecute heads of state for things they do internally. And in Charles Taylor's case, it was Sierra Leone prosecuting him for contributing to their war.
Right, crossing the border.
Rather than the Liberia.
Right.
But having said that, you know, Bashar al-Assad and his allies may not know the intricacies of this. And if a case can be made to Assad that this could be your fate, I think a case was potentially made to Ali Abdullah Saleh of Yemen that could be your fate, a war crimes tribunal. And it is, you know, one of many levers that can be used to usher out a leader like Assad out of power. But in any sort of agreement, he would have to be given some kind of immunity from this sort of action. So certainly the answer is yes, it can be used as an important lever.
By the way, a comment on our webpage asks, what about Bush and Cheney? And that may sound outrageous to some Americans, but many corners of the world do actually consider them heads of state war criminals for things that were done in Iraq.
Right. And as I said, it's a little bit, more complicated, because a lot of these, a lot of governments have put in place laws that make that kind of prosecution a little bit more difficult. But in the case of Charles Taylor, he was prosecuted for things he did regarding Sierra Leone. So in that case, the Bush and Cheney analogy would obtain to some extent vis-a-vis Iraq. But as you and I both know, that's very unlikely to happen.
Afshin Mallavi, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation and former Tehran-based correspondent for The Washington Post. Very insightful. Thank you very, very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Alison Bechdel on her new cartoon memoir, Are You My Mother? A Comic Drama. Do you know Alison Bechdel's work? She is a rock star among her fans. We'll get her thoughts on what to do when your mother doesn't want you to write a memoir about her and things like that. Alison Bechdel coming up next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.